Welcome to Blockstars, Ripple's podcast that features leaders and developers in crypto and blockchain to discuss the latest trends, technologies, and the real-world problems being solved. I'm your host, Ripple CTO David Schwartz. Today, we delve into the topic of blockchain and crypto security, exploring the challenges and innovative solutions that shape the landscape. For those that know the industry well and have been developing and building on blockchain for a long time, you know that blockchain and security are almost synonymous. Because of blockchain's decentralized nature, lack of single points of failure, and immutability, one of, perhaps the most important even, characteristics of blockchain technology is inherent security. As the technology and its applications advance and evolve, so do the complexities surrounding the broader Web3 ecosystem, including bad actors, scammers, and others looking to game the system. Joining us today to discuss the importance of blockchain and crypto security are Eri Redborn, Global Head of Policy and Government Affairs at TRM Labs, and Rongwei Gu, co-founder of Certiq and Associate Professor at Columbia University. Welcome to Blockstars. It's fantastic to have you both here.
Hey, thank you so much for for having us today.
Yeah, thank you.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves and the organizations? Why don't you start, Eri?
Yeah, no, thank you again. Yeah, so as you said, I'm Eri Redborn, the Global Head of Policy at TRM Labs. Prior to joining TRM, I spent about 11 years at the U.S. Department of Justice as a federal prosecutor. I focused on sort of that intersection of national security and money laundering, what I call threat finance. So terrorist financiers, sanctions, criminal prosecutions, cyber criminals, and others who were trying to raise funds to do bad things. I then spent about 2 years at the U.S. Treasury Department as a senior advisor to the deputy secretary and the undersecretary for terrorism and financial intelligence, which is a mouthful only in U.S. government type title. But I basically worked to oversee the national security apparatus at Treasury. So OFAC, which is the sanctions authority, FinCEN, which is the financial intelligence unit, and other sort of national security components. And yeah, I did this crazy thing about 3 years ago where I joined what was about an 8-person startup on a mission to build a safer financial system. We're about 200, 220 today across 30 countries, working with law enforcement, regulators, working with cryptocurrency businesses like Ripple and financial institutions to do compliance and to keep their platforms safe. I know we're going to delve a lot more into that as we talk today.
Rongwei?
Yeah, thank you, David. So I'm Rongwei Gu. I'm a computer science professor at Columbia University. I'm also a co-founder of Certiq, a blockchain cybersecurity firm. So my research is focusing on formal verification. Just basically try to use this technology to help provide mathematical guarantees for software. And before starting Certiq, I built Certiq OS, which is the first fully verified multi-processor OS kernel, which is proven to be hacker-resistant and bug-free. And that's Certiq OS has been deployed on the Landshark machine, which is an unmanned vehicle and actually supported by DARPA. And after that, I try to apply those formal verification techniques to blockchain domain and started Certiq. Certiq has served many big players in the blockchain industry, including Ripple. And we have provided our auditing and cybersecurity services to more than 4,000 enterprise clients. And I have helped secure more than $300 billion worth of crypto currencies. And we are also at this moment working with many financial institutes and major corporates from the traditional industry to help them embrace this new technology and enter this Web3 space.
Over the years, blockchain has experienced quite a journey. Bitcoin's introduction in the industry has continued to grow, more and more platforms with unique features and use cases. And I think also an increase in complexity with the introduction of things like smart contracts. The blockchains themselves have a relatively good security history with very, very few security issues at the blockchain level itself. XRP Ledger has been around for more than a decade. There have been not a single security breach of the ledger itself. I would say it's a testament to the robustness of its architecture and the dedication of the community behind it. Bitcoin had one or maybe two, both rapidly repaired by its community. That isn't where the real security, the security problem is not so much in the blockchain itself, but it's in all of the complicated stuff that we need to build around it. And I think probably the majority of security incidents, at least that I know about, have involved smart contract issues, these self-executing contracts that enable automation in a wide range of applications. But they bring their own set of opportunities and risks, right?
Of course. So smart contracts is kind of like a new kind of programs, right, that can run on top of blockchain. And that's also very revolution, in a sense that it enable people to encode business logic on top of blockchain and let these smart contracts run automatically. Right, to run the business and so on. And in this procedure, you don't need to trust some centralized entities like banks, other financial institutes, right? That's the spirit and the beauty of blockchain technology. But meanwhile, this definitely introduced lots of risk in a sense that now you have to trust these smart contracts of code, that including the logic. In this space, we say that in code, we trust. But code itself is not trustworthy because it may contain security bugs. It may have some mismatch between the mismatches between the implementation and the design, right? And also for many people who are interacting with this smart contracts, they don't know how to do coding. They can't check the security and safety of these smart contracts. So that's introduced lots of, I would say, new challenges to this space together with the opportunities they brought.
Yeah, it's cool to be on and to listen to that and be on with Rungwei, because I think that we're thinking about kind of two different pieces of this that come together very nicely. There's the key cybersecurity angle, and then it's sort of what happens when a breach occurs. And that's very much what sort of TRM does, and that is tracing the flow of funds on public blockchains. But sort of going back to that sort of initial premise, look, the same qualities that make crypto such a force for good, right? This idea of cross-border value transfer at the speed of the internet also make it very attractive to illicit actors who want to move larger amounts of funds faster cross-border than ever before. So, you know, you talk about sort of the risks today. You know, according to TRM, we saw about 600 million in hacks last year from North Korea. That is down significantly from 2022, which was a record-setting year. However, still way, way too much. You know, we saw them in 2022, which is what got the numbers up, steal $600 million in one fell swoop from the Ronin Bridge, which is part of the play-to-earn game Axie Infinity. So you really see North Korea and other cyber actors really attacking the crypto ecosystem at unprecedented speed and scale, much to Rungwei's sort of point about, hey, as we're building, maybe these sort of, you know, smaller DeFi protocols and others in the space are not necessarily building cybersecurity as sort of foundational infrastructure. There's a whole bunch of other illicit finance risks, but when we're thinking about those attacks on blockchains, obviously, you know, hacks, you sort of immediately come to mind, but there's a sort of obviously other illicit finance risks we can sort of get deeper on as well.
So would you say are smart contracts and bridges like the two biggest?
I'd say that's, I say today. Today most of the sort of cyber activity, the hacks, the exploits are occurring in the DeFi ecosystem for sure. But I think one thing that's really important whenever we discuss this is to also say, look, but the difference when you're talking about financial crime investigations or hacks today is that what blockchains allows, particularly open blockchains, is law enforcement and national security officials to follow the money in ways they simply never could. You know, I mentioned I was a prosecutor for many years. You know, I focused my cases on, you know, networks of shell companies and hawalas and you know, high value art and real estate, right? There was no TRM for those things. So like on the one hand, now cyber criminals can steal larger amounts of funds than ever before, but now law enforcement and frankly, compliance professionals at cryptocurrency businesses and financial institutions can now actually follow the money in ways they never could before to potentially seize it back. And we're seeing a lot of that happening as well. So it's the cat and mouse game has sort of just moved to the digital space, but it's very much the game that we've been seeing for many years.
What are the components of this sort of response? I mean, I guess there's things like auditing smart contracts. There's things like user education, because if a user doesn't care if a smart contract's audited or not, all the auditing in the world won't protect them. And then there's what you just mentioned, I guess, which is sort of the sort of post post-incident sort of tracking the money, stopping the money. And of course, if criminals know that they're not going to be able to get money out, then they're less incentivized. I think it's also an interesting observation that I think previously there was no way that you could sort of in an automated way at scale steal large amounts of money that were irreversible. And I think that's
like, the paradox. That's really the paradox here. I'll let Ramon take the first part of that question on the smart contracts, but happy to kind of jump into the latter part.
Sure, Ramon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So as Ari and Devin mentioned as well, it's fully automated on-chain and a blockchain, we call it world computer that no one can stop, right? In a sense that once, let's say, pass the smart contract funds being transferred, no one can, let's say, on Bitcoin, no one can stop that transaction. And so that's why they are, it's a new, brand new technology and a new technology stack. And there are also many, many new kind of risks. And we have to build, I would say, end-to-end, one-stop, let's say, cybersecurity services and products, try to reduce the risk, let's say, at the development cycle, at the before the deployment and after the deployment, and before the breach has happened and after the breach just happened. So many, many things need to be done. For example, like the Ronin Network example, right, I already just mentioned. So actually, we worked with Ronin Networks after the breach. But that's hack is not due to smart contracts or blockchain. Actually, it's related to private key leakage, right? Because see, while there's all these new kinds of risks that people may not realize.
Yeah, that's a really, really important point. I was going to kind of get to that. It's like you mentioned a bunch of different ways that hackers attack the ecosystem. You know, social engineering has been a hallmark of North Korea cyber criminals for so long. And that really just comes down to education and the weakness of sort of people that's existed for really since people ever existed. So it's like, you know, a lot of it is that kind of education at that engineering employee sort of level to ensure that they're not clicking on links that allow access, which was actually what happened in the Ronin attack. Sort of, you know, look, I think that a hack is usually a breach of cyber controls, right? On some level, whether it's social engineering or something else. What then really happens is the incident response when you're talking about a hack in particular. And that is working with law enforcement to follow the flow of funds. And we've seen a fair amount of success. Interestingly, you know, in 2016, the biggest hack at the time was of the Bitfinex exchange. It was about $70 million in Bitcoin. Well, law enforcement used tools like TRM to follow those flow of funds for 5 years. They followed those funds through mixers and in and out of darknet markets, chain hopping, you know, all kinds of different types of obfuscation techniques. But law enforcement was able to follow the funds as the technology got better and ultimately was able to seize back those funds. By the time they seized them back in about 2021, they were worth about $4.2 billion, which is just sort of a function of the price of Bitcoin over that time, which was really, it was the largest seizure of anything in U.S. history. But when you talk about sort of that next step, it really is a law enforcement, places like IRS, criminal investigations, Homeland Security, FBI, are working with tools like TRM and others to track and trace those flow of funds. And it's something that absolutely can be done today and seized back, but it becomes a race between cyber criminals and law enforcement and private sector.
Yeah, I guess when I was thinking about most of the landscape being smart contract, tax, and bridges, I guess I was forgetting about things like ransomware, which is not so much a fault of the crypto infrastructure, but obviously still a problem that needs to be addressed on the get the money out side. And then there's also hacks of crypto infrastructure, like attacks on exchanges. And then I guess two broad categories of social media scams being the sort of fake news social media scam, which there's not much you can do from the crypto or blockchain side on that. But then there's another aspect of the sort of social media scam that maybe we can do more on the blockchain side, which is the sort of like scam, like send me crypto and I'll send you back twice as much, or, you know, these giveaway scams, those kinds of things, which are often trying to get people to, you know, surrender their private keys. I guess the common factor in all of these, though, is that the criminal has to get their money out. And presumably, if they get blocked at off ramps, or, you know, I guess that's sort of a response for the sort of common to all of these attack models.
Yeah, I think I absolutely think that's right. Just to give you some sort of sense of this, you know, we're TRM. I think this is like breaking news. I'm not sure we've put this number out, but we saw about $10.6 billion in fraud last year within the crypto ecosystem, fraud and scams. And that includes things like pig butchering and, you know, and Ponzi schemes and that sort of thing. So it's and I think this is gets to kind of like the social media scams that you're talking about and the different sort of romance scams and this type of thing. And it's very, very real. But you're absolutely right about the off-ramps, right? Like the key is to have controls on the off-ramps. Like you can't really launder funds in a meaningful way within DeFi today, because the reality is you still need to find off-ramps to use those funds and convert those funds. And I think that really where the work needs to be done is at the sort of centralized exchanges to ensure that they have the on and off-ramps. I think there's a very good job being done today in places like the US, but there's certainly vulnerabilities, right? There's a host of Russia-related or Russia-based exchanges that don't have controls in place. But you see US Treasury also sent using sanctions and other types of enforcement actions against those. So you're absolutely right. It's a huge issue. One sort of just thing before I end is there is, I think, a lot the community can do, the cryptocurrency community overall. We run a website called chainabuse.com, which is just open source, open for anyone. It's kind of a ways for fraud and scams where you can just go on and basically just say, hey, I was a victim here. You can report to law enforcement or just to members of the community. So I think there are some sort of self-regulatory things we can do to share information. Again, because of the unique qualities of blockchain, you actually don't need a sophisticated tool, right? You see sleuths on Twitter and all over the place using Etherscan and other types of tools to do this type of investigation. So look, I think that the blockchain allows for all kinds of new and innovative ways to do investigation, to do security. But again, like you can still move more funds faster than ever before, which is the paradox.
Yeah. So here I want to add a few sentences about education. So I will say that, as Aaron mentioned as well, there's all these tools that you can use to do investigation and so on. But we also observe that many of the participants in early adoption of this blockchain and so on, so they may not be expert. In the sense that we heard some of the people saying that, well, I heard that blockchain is secure by design, by construction. Why my money got stolen, and they don't even know how their money got stolen and so on when they click some links and so on. So that's why I think education is still very, very important. That's why Certiq, we have the Certiq Alert Twitter accounts and page. We keep, when we identify any hacks, scams, and so on, so we're gonna alert the community. And in the past 2 years, we have posted more than thousands of tweets and received lots of views and so on.
What about from the financial institution side? I think we've seen a lot of financial institutions that basically say, we just don't want to have customers that deal with crypto. We just don't want to deal with it, because obviously it's something that is complex, and you know, they have issues with anonymous transactions and so on. Are there better things that they might be able to do than just not taking on customers who are doing things with crypto?
I hope so, for all of our sake. So yes, David, absolutely yes. You know, it's interesting. We work with some of the largest financial institutions in the world, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, really across the world. And I think that like almost every financial institution is at some part of their crypto journey today, whether it's kind of to your question is like, hey, should we bank this crypto customer, all the way to like JP Morgan is like, hey, we've issued a token. And folks like Goldman Sachs in between, they're like, we want to offer crypto assets to customers. You see this new sort of ETF news, which obviously a lot of institutional players are getting involved in. So I think they're doing a lot of the same stuff that crypto exchanges are in those instances, right? They're doing transaction monitoring, which they've done in fiat for years. They're doing wallet screening to ensure that their platforms are not engaging with a terrorist financier or a ransomware group. They're using blockchain intelligence for those things. So I think that, look, like, you know, 3 years ago when I got to TRM, it was really fun to see how many large financial institutions were sort of leaning in. I think we saw a lot of leaning out when FTX happened. And I'm hopeful that we're in this moment right now where we're seeing a little bit more leaning in again. So I think it's very much a we'll see, but there are absolutely tools out there that can allow them to mitigate these risks. And, you know, it's like anything else. Like, I think we're seeing that consumers want access to cryptocurrency, to digital assets. And I think that ultimately the financial institutions that's what will really move the needle.
Yeah, so I want to provide some story on our Certiq side. So we are kind of like the go-to person for crypto cybersecurity consultants for these kind of like big financial institutes. And also we have been working with some regulators in in let's say US, in Europe, and in Asia. And so what we observe, first of all, we are happy to see that more and more financial institutes or traditional institutes, they trying to embrace this new technology. And many of them have do something like in the privileged blockchain, which is now public. And some of them, they try to, let's say, even deploy smart contracts on public blockchain, which, to be honest, is they feel not that comfortable. So they talk with us a lot. And actually, the thing is, the most questions we received are still about how to manage their private keys safely and how to manage the crypto assets. Yeah,
that is a challenge, because on the one hand, if you lose your own private keys, you've lost all, and if anybody else gets to your, so you want to keep them in like as few places as possible. But then if anybody else gets them, so you have these tensions pulling in opposite directions. I wanted to talk a little bit about smart contract verification and auditing. So auditing is pretty self-explanatory, like someone who's an expert looks at it. But formal verification, maybe some people are not familiar with this. What if you want to explain what formal verification is and tell me how advanced is it and how relevant is it today and possibly in the future?
Yeah. So first of all, actually, I want to clarify some misunderstanding related to auditing. So many people feel like, well, auditing is finding secret bugs. And I would say there are still some differences between these two things. Auditing, beyond finding bugs, we're also trying to show that the implementation, the code there, and is consistent with your design, it's consistent with what you claim, right? This is also one of the job of the auditing. Then in terms of formal verification, so formal verification is a technology trying to mathematically prove that a piece of code is 100% consistent with the design, which we call specification. So you can view the code as a computation model. You can also view the design and the specification as a computation model. And formal verification is trying to mathematically prove that these two models are consistent. So that's the underlying idea of this technology. And in terms of smart contracts and auditing, you can see that, well, this is a very powerful tool, right, to make sure that, well, the smart contracts you implement satisfy the specification. And so on. So that will bring in it's a very powerful way to establish trust. As I mentioned, right? So in this decentralized world, we don't have this as a big institute and so on. And people have to trust code, but most people can't understand the code. And so we need some way to build a trust saying that this code is consistent with what you design and what you can claim for.
Where are we on formal verification? Like I'm not certainly not an expert on formal verification. My sort of non-expert opinion is that it's fascinating, but not really practical, that we can't really formally verify anything complicated or interesting enough to have much real world relevance. Is that right? Or am I years out of date?
Yeah, I would say that this is indeed, formal verification is indeed very, very difficult because you can see this is mathematically proof and we want to prove for all conditions. So this, the search space can be very large and it's very complex. And I can share some of the successful story that Certiq has done in the past. For example, let's say what it can be applied to. So it's definitely not a cure to all the issues, but I can share some of the stories. First is about, let's say, consensus, right? When you design consensus, you want to prove that your consensus indeed, let's say, satisfy the properties you want to hold, right? For example, it indeed can't be attacked by, let's say, less than 40% of the votes, right? One of something like you cannot avoid 51% attack, but you hope that, well, that is a threshold, right? You want to prove this kind of like properties. This is something formal verification can do, and we help, let's say, Tang. Certiq help verify the consensus protocol for Tang, the blockchain built by Telegram, right? And this is one application. The second application is we can try to, for zero knowledge proof, right, which is pretty new technology, which is also very hot at this moment, but it's very, very complex. The complexity is not the implementation is huge. It's because, well, this mathematical things is too hard to check, all right? When you look at the code, it's very, very hard to check. So what we do is we, for example, Certiq is working with ZK Wasm to help them verify the translation of ZK instructions. We help them verify, let's say, 144 instructions one by one. Each of them, I would say, implementation is not complex, but the mathematical thing is complex. And third thing is for simple smart contracts, yes, we can do verification like a ERC-20 token, ERC-721, something like that. We can do fully automated verification.
Yeah, the RippleX engineering team recently used your firm to audit the automated market maker feature for the XRP ledger. Yeah. And I noticed in the report there were things that I would say would be like traditional bugs, like this code has a bug. And then there were things that were like, you want your code to do this, and it almost does that, but it doesn't quite do that. And then there were other things that were like, your specification says your code should do this, and your code does do that, but are you really sure you want it to do that?
yep. You know. It's a great question, and I would say it's also an enjoyable journey for us to work with Ripple, a very, very professional team. So as you mentioned, first, we want to understand what's the real design, right? And so that's why a CERTIC team and Ripple team, right, and the developers for XRP, we have tons of meetings, I believe, right? Lots of discussion, tons of meetings. We review the document, all the documents, right, and so on. So first, we want to understand the design. And second, we want to understand, I say, the document, the specification. And there may be some mismatch in the sense that what you design for may not be, you know, something, I would say, entirely secure or something, well, that follows the best practice and so on. So we want to help you, right? So CERTIC is trying to help, let's say, the XRP developer, right, to fully justify and fix the design first. And then we want to find the mismatches between the specification and the design. And then we try to find the bugs in the implementation. So actually, it's multi-layer stuff.
So let's say we screw that all up. We did everything we could to avoid a compromise, and we have one anyway. So what then? I guess this is more of a question for Ari at TRM Labs, more post-compromise. If all of that stuff didn't work despite our best efforts, what happens?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And look, I think that it really depends. And the hope is that, you know, our team, we have a global investigations team that's sourced from, you know, former IRS criminal investigations and FBI and HSI and others, who are, you know, really original tracers of cryptocurrency in the U.S. government and then globally, Australia, federal police, the Met Police in the U.K. And they work really closely with law enforcement to trace and track the flow of those funds, hopefully to an exchange or somewhere there where ultimately you can block, they can block those funds. There can be, law enforcement can get a subpoena as to learn more about who the individuals are. Because remember, you know, blockchain intelligence tools like TRM, what we do is we add threat intelligence to that alphanumeric sort of crypto address that you see on chain. We do not associate individuals. So we do not say, hey, that's David's address, that's Rongwei's address. So you essentially need a subpoena. Law enforcement needs a subpoena to do that. So they'll work with an exchange on that, hopefully. So very much it's a follow the money. And there are great examples of this. I mentioned Bitfinex. You had the Colonial Pipeline. You mentioned ransomware, David, a few minutes ago, attack where the FBI was able to follow the money using blockchain intelligence tools to a wallet address where they were ultimately able to seize those funds back. So, you know, there are some successes. There's somewhere where there are where it's very, very difficult to do, but it sort of continues to be part of it. So it's very much sort of a, you know, a hack occurs and you start to immediately try to understand where those funds move. One really interesting piece, and I'm talking mostly from sort of a law enforcement and incident response standpoint, but regulators are also using these tools out there. So for example, Rongwei and I both mentioned the Ronin attack. Right after that attack, within a few days, OFAC, which is the sanctions regulator in the US, actually sanctioned the addresses where those funds moved. Okay, so sort of alert the world that, hey, you should not be transacting with those addresses. Or if you're an exchange, you should not allow those addresses access to your platform. Then interestingly, they continued to watch the funds move. And then they sanctioned Blender.io, which is a Bitcoin-based mixer where those funds went for facilitating money laundering. They then watched those funds flow again to Tornado Cash, which was an Ethereum, a decentralized mixing service on Ethereum. A lot of controversy around that, sort of not getting into that in this answer. But the reality is now regulators have the opportunity to watch funds flow in real time and take action, take enforcement actions. That didn't happen in the real world. You know, we would sit for weeks or longer in conference rooms coming up with targets and talking about, hey, is this, you know, do we have approval to go after this one? Or how do we know, what's the evidence? Here, it's here. It's all on the blockchain. The blockchain is a giant crime scene that allows us to see in real time how bad actors are acting. And it's why it's safer than transacting ultimately in the real world.
So is it getting better? Are we catching more of greater percentage of these stolen funds?
I think the answer is yes, it's getting better. We continue to see sort of illicit activity as an overall percentage drop. We see fewer hacks. You know, I mentioned North Korea, 600 million. That was still about half of what we saw last year overall in the crypto ecosystem. So 2023, we saw about half of the hack activity, and probably because it really starts with the great work Runway and others are doing at the sort of cyber level, the cybersecurity level, to ensure that bad actors aren't gaining access. But then, quite frankly, like, you know, the tools like TRM are getting better. Law enforcement is getting more educated. You're having more folks be able to do this. So I think it's absolutely getting better. There's still a long way to go, but overall, you're seeing more and more successes. I will say, I think the challenges as blockchain scale, as more and more transactions are done on public open ledgers, there's going to be a need for more and more privacy. And I think the challenge is, how do we allow lawful users a degree of privacy in an open financial system, but at the same time stop illicit actors from taking advantage of it? And I think that's sort of the challenge I'm thinking about all the time, is how do we balance the privacy versus security piece?
You know, one of the first things I thought about as you were talking about some of the sort of expansion of the sanctions from what's clearly the bad actors to like the tools that the bad actors are using, is that there's going to be some collateral damage.
And that's exactly right. And I think that to me is the biggest challenge. We responded, the Treasury Department did a notice of proposed rulemaking on mixers that we responded to this week. And I think that's the real challenge, right? Like, mixing activity is not bad. But when North Korea uses a mixer to launder $1 billion, that's bad. So it's figuring out, how do we allow lawful users to use privacy-enhancing tools in an open financial system, but at the same time keep North Korea, terrorist financiers, ransomware groups off these platforms? And I think that technology solutions is ultimately the answer for this. The things that Runway is built, or folks like Runway are building, digital ID, zero knowledge proofs. I think there are tech solutions to this, as opposed to sort of over-regulating or regulating these businesses out of existence.
So what can people who are developing smart contracts or blockchain protocols, people who are building new things, what kind of things could they potentially do to prevent the things that they build from being the next targets of these types of, you know, particularly scams and hacks?
I can start and feel free to jump on in here, Runway. Like, you know, I think part of it is that I'll sort of answer in your way first. And that is, like, I think understanding that cybersecurity is critical infrastructure as we build. We have to always be thinking about it. It's not an afterthought. We get hacked and then we build it. It's from the get-go. If you're building in DeFi, you have got to think about security and really kind of build that in. And then the other piece is, you know, we work today with most of the leading DeFi protocols. We work with Uniswap and Oneinch and Aave and others at their front end, right? We're ensuring that users who are going through their websites they're doing transaction monitoring, they're doing wallet screening, they're doing the compliance sanctions screening, they're doing what they can. I think the bigger challenge is, you know, when bad actors are going around the front end to the protocol layer, and there's not a lot of compliance done there today. But I love when I talk to builders who are building that, you know, from a digital ID perspective or zero knowledge proofs. And I think there are tech answers to that. And I would encourage folks who are building to definitely be always thinking about, how am I keeping my platform safe? And I'll stop with this, right? Like, you know, I was a national security prosecutor for most of my career. That's usually the hat I'm wearing. I really want to stop bad actors from getting money to do weapons proliferation and destabilizing activity. But if you don't care about any of that, if you just care about crypto, right? Like, if you just care about this ecosystem growing, we have to keep these platforms safe, right? Or no one's going to put their funds on a protocol, on a bridge, in an exchange, if they think North Korea is going to steal the money, you know, within a couple months. So I think that it's important for so many reasons. But if you're a builder in this space, it's absolutely critical foundational infrastructure.
Yeah, I can share more of our experience. So we are building, you know, cybersecurity tools, auditing tools, right? So we're working with Ripple. Ripple give us code and we can scan the code and find the bugs, right? Potential bugs and so on. Right? That's our job. But it's also very, I would say, dangerous, right? As David asked that, how we can make sure that the tools that we built will not be utilized by bad actors. I can share some of the stories. For example, we're working with some of the bridges clients, and we identify critical bugs, and then we build a tool for it, and we run it, we scan it for other bridges, and we found critical bugs in Wormhole. At that point, $900 million was in risk. So we directly contact with them. They fix it very quickly, and then we make announcements, and we help them find the bugs, and they give us a pretty big amount of a bounty. But the thing is dangerous, right? In a sense, if let's say some of the people have the access to our tool and it's not a well monitored or managed, and he may now choose to report the bug bounty because the $900 million is definitely much, much bigger than the bounty itself. So that's why many people ask us why Certiq can't simply release the automated tools or your scanning tools to the public to contribute to the community, because we feel like, well, this is a double-edged weapon. And internally, we're also very, I would say, careful in the sense that we build lots of internal monitoring system, like who, when they use the tool, everything's logged. And when they find some things, we'll make sure that, well, these bugs are reported in the correct way.
Let's talk about the potential impact of AI in sort of both sides of this. So I've thought a lot about using AI to track the movement of funds and to look for suspicious accounts to say, or the opposite, just like, hey, this account might look suspicious. Like, no, like AI says that that's actually like what hundreds of perfect accounts we know to be legitimate are doing, or using AI to figure out like which accounts belong to, you know, exchanges or identifying suspicious behavior. And then on the other side, maybe we could use AI to write smart contracts in the first instance so that we'd know that no malicious actor had hidden something in it. And then, of course, auditing of smart contracts. What do you guys think about the use of AI on both sides of this problem, and what kind of time frame might be realistic to see some real progress?
I'll take the first part, and you can jump in on the smart contract part. I think the answer is we already are in really many respects, and AI I know takes very many different forms, but just like I think we're thinking about it in a couple ways. First, the way we have a team of threat hunters that are out there, you know, on social media sites, on password protected Telegram channels, gaining what we call primary attribution. Hey, we know that that address is associated with a terrorist financier. Well, how? Well, we saw that address, you know, from Mujahideen raising funds on Twitter, right? We know that. But then what we do is we use machine learning algorithms to extrapolate, right? Hey, what addresses has that address transacted with? You know, what are the universe of actors? How do they look? How are they transacting with other folks to really sort of try to that's how you build out the attribution that we provide to folks like Ripple and the FBI and others. So that's the one piece, the sort of data science piece. And an additional piece is, I think at TRM, we're building this giant blacklist of cryptocurrency addresses, for lack of a better description, right? But the reality is that's not going to scale. In a world in which bad actors can spin up essentially shell companies, right, crypto addresses at the click of a button, you can't build attribution fast enough to catch that. So what you need to do is you need to understand patterns of illicit activity. And I think, David, this is what you were getting to, right? I know that if there's $50 million from a hack, you're not going to send it directly to Coinbase, right? You're going to send it through a series of intermediaries. That's a signature, what we call a TRM, a signature of money laundering. And we're using all kinds of data science to understand what are different signatures and patterns of behavior. If you send a large amount of funds and peel small amounts off along the way, we call that a peeling chain, right? That is a pattern on a blockchain that we're using machine learning and data science to really sort of understand that. So I think that the short answer, and I hope this got to your question, is we're already using the type of data science I think you're referring to today, although I know that there's all kinds of definitions of AI.
Yeah, I can talk about the smart contracts part. So actually we have already seen that AI technology has been widely used in developing programs, right? Writing codes. And now there are Copilot and similar tools that can help developers to, you know, to write smart contracts in a much faster way. But the thing is, you know, this LLM-based technology, they basically try to train or learn from all the code that are publicly available, right? And learn how to write code for you. And the thing is, they not only will learn the code, but also learn the bugs that in the, let's say, public code base. The thing is, the developer may not fully understand the code generated by the AI, so auditing becomes even more important to what we said, let's say, AI-generated code. So we want to make sure that what this code indeed, right, satisfy the design and the specification. We have seen that more and more code has been generated by AI. And then people is talking about, well, can we use AI to do auditing? Right. So first of all, AI technology is, especially the LLM-based ones, they are not that strong with reasoning. And so to auditing and so on, I would say still we try all these, you know, models and so on, still not far from enough. But AI can help, I would say, improve the auditing efficiency. For example, at this moment, we use LLM-based technology to help us, you know, how to deliver a vulnerability to, let's say, a client, like how to, you know, explain that's what happened and why this is a critical bug and so on. We find that part is very useful, basically, to generating this examples, reports, and so on.
Let's talk about social media and entities like Facebook that I refuse to call Meta, Telegram, Twitter, which I refuse to call X. How are they responsive? Do they care? Do they seem to care about these issues? Are they overwhelmed? What's been in your experience? Have they helped?
I'm happy to sort of jump in from a more of a law enforcement standpoint, like getting information from them, or more from a technical sort of cyber standpoint.
I'm more interested. I guess it's all interesting. I think I'm specifically interested in whether they're actively trying to stop people from being scammed on their platform, like giveaway scams and private key thefts and those types of things. Because anyone who's on social media in the crypto space sees hundreds of these things. If I post something on Twitter, there will be at least two or three scam responses before any human has even had a chance to read it. And it just seems, I guess maybe it's they're facing such a large problem that even if they're addressing it diligently, it still looks like they're not, because it's still a constant barrage. But it looks like they're just not even trying.
I think the short answer is I don't know. I certainly see a lot of it as well everywhere I turn. I can tell you anecdotally, and I don't know if this was from social media or from somewhere else, but Chris Jancheski, former IRS CI agent who leads our global investigations team, and I were both a victim of someone essentially reaching out to someone who was scammed and saying that they were us, right? Yeah. This was like a couple of weeks ago, and saying they were us and we wanted to come help recover the funds for this person, if you send us, I don't remember what it was, you know, a couple thousand dollars. And it literally broke my heart to read the emails. These were emails like were so different than any way I would ever communicate with a victim, right? I was like a lifelong prosecutor, and like it was absolutely awful. And there's just so much of this going on, and your heart aches. Yeah. I think that like a lot of it is education. There's no question. And a lot of it is like state and local law enforcement are really close to these issues, because these are, you know, mom and pop businesses. These are like retirees who don't understand how some of this technology works. So it's a huge, huge problem. There are a lot of great people. Aaron West is a prosecutor in Santa Clara who's like really, really talks about pig butchering all the time, and I think is bringing a ton of awareness to it. But it's something that like I think more and more awareness needs to happen. And maybe some of these social media platforms are a great place to really lean in on the awareness piece, right? Like, hey, really telling people about like, hey, what they're seeing on these platforms. But the answer is, I don't know. I see it all the time, and I don't know exactly the steps these folks are taking to sort of remove it from their platforms.
Well, that was depressing. Let's talk about something.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. It's awful. Yeah.
How's the regulatory environment as far? I mean, we all know about the regulatory environment as far as like the legality of crypto businesses and everything. But what about from the standpoint of addressing scams, particularly scams where people in the crypto space are the victims?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good going on right now globally in terms of from a regulatory perspective. I work really closely with Ripple's global policy team, Rahul Advani, who leads that effort in APAC, is in Singapore. we've done a bunch of sort of conferences, and inevitably at those conferences, the issues around pig butchering and other types of scams and frauds and sort of mitigating those risks come up. And that's been great. I think I mentioned chain abuse earlier, like a way for the industry to kind of come together to really take control. It's not just a law enforcement issue. It's not just a regulatory issue. I think from just that pure scams and fraud, it really is the industry. And I've seen the industry really step up around this, which is really important. And then you see, consumer, if you ask regulators around the world, from the MAS in Singapore to the JFSA in Japan, frankly, to the Treasury Department and others in the US and in the UK, in the EU, they would all say consumer protection is probably the number one focus right now. So I think a lot of it is education, a lot of it is advertising, and kind of really getting aggressive around that from a scam and fraud perspective. We can talk about all the other mess in the regulatory space today, but I think this is someplace that folks are very, very focused.
Yeah, so Sterling is also working with many regulators at this moment, like we work with Japan, FSA, Malaysia, governments. I also personally serve as an advisor to Singapore MAS and also the Hong Kong called Web3 Task Force. And one thing we observe at this moment that many of these governments are working on stable coin related policies and so on. And also we are helping them drafting some of them. So one interesting thing is when I attend the Singapore MAS, this annual meeting, that day, Paxos is also one of Sterling's clients, get the license, the stable coin license at Singapore. And we talk about it also during the MS annual meeting. And so first of all, I realized that they mostly focus on this, well, all the stable coins are backed by, you know, US dollars and something like that. I talk about, let's say, the risk in smart contracts. I talk about the, let's say, the risk in this money laundering, right, scams and so on. But seems like these parts are still not well, I would say, considered in the policy and so on. So I would say I believe TRM, Ari, and we're gonna push really hard on this side.
Yeah, just David, like, just thank you, like, for bringing us together. I think just like listening to this, I think there's so much cool stuff we could probably do together to help keep the ecosystem safe. So like, definitely thank you for the intro. This has been it's cool.
It's been fun for me too. So there's that balance between not choking innovation, and of course providing, like, you know, in the regulatory space, we usually talk about, like, quote unquote investor protection, like protecting the people who from decisions that they would knowingly make that may violate the law. And then of course we have this dealing with the scams and things like terrorist financing. I recently did an episode. I talked with Stu Alderodi, our chief legal officer, about we talked about the regulatory front, and we really kind of had a blind spot. Like, all we thought about is the regulatory front. It's like, can cryptocurrency companies and projects operate legally? Right. We weren't so much thinking about, like, how can we protect people from like outright fraud and scams? Are those two regulatory fronts connected, or are they two different? Are they sort of two different battles?
You know, I do see them as sort of two different battles. And Stu and I have spent a lot of time together, and I love his perspective. And he actually focuses on an area I spend less time, and that is sort of this argument around, obviously, you know, who is going to regulate, particularly in the U.S., in the cryptocurrency space. And I think, sadly, in the U.S., we've spent all of this time on who's going to regulate and have never really even gotten to the how we're going to regulate. Whereas if you look in the rest of the world, you know, we're seeing how you can regulate, right? You see MiCA in the EU, the market and crypto assets legislation. You see Rongwei mentioned the JFSA in Japan and MAS in Singapore. They've all gotten to the how we're going to regulate stage of the game. In the UK, we're sort of seeing a lot of the same. So I think they are kind of discrete, because one reason I love being in the sort of like anti-money laundering, you know, terror financing space is it's actually a lot more clear. Like, ask Stu, right? It's not clear whether it's a security or a commodity, but it is really clear that FinCEN says if you are a cryptocurrency business today, right, that touches U.S. persons or engages with any kind of U.S. customer, then you are essentially a money service business. Now, DeFi might be a little different, and we can delve into that. But if you're a broker, if you're an exchange, if you're a custodian, right, you are a money service business, which means you have compliance obligations today under the Bank Secrecy Act, which is the U.S. anti-money laundering law. So, you know, there's not a lot of clarity. We talk about clarity all the time in all kinds of areas. This is one where it's kind of clear. Like, businesses know that they have to have compliance controls in place, that they, you know, New York Department of Financial Services, for example, if you want to be a licensed entity in New York, which essentially a lot of folks do, you essentially have to have a compliance tool today like TRM, right? You have to do transaction monitoring. You have to have compliance teams. You have to respond to law enforcement subpoena. So I say that to say, like, there's a lot of messes out there in the regulatory space, and like, we need a lot more clarity on some things. This is actually the one aspect that's like pretty clear. And the Financial Action Task Force, which is not a regulator, but it's a global standard setter, has made that clear from a global perspective as well, that that's what they expect from jurisdictions.
Yeah, I talked on a previous episode a lot about how institutions can adopt DeFi if there is literally no way to do sanction screening. Like, it's not enough for them to do sanction screening when they bring money into the system or out. Like, they're going to be involved in transactions where their funds are moving that, you know, they have no control over. And we talked a lot about how to square that circle and build compliant DeFi.
I think quite frankly, it's probably the most interesting question in the space today. You know, we've been really focused on centralized exchanges for years about how to regulate them. And I think the much more interesting questions are around how do you do compliance sanctions or AML in the decentralized space? I think there are answers to those. I think there are technology solutions, but it's complicated.
Well, we're just about out of time. I always like to wrap up my Blockstars episodes by doing something guests usually don't like, which I ask them to bring out their crystal balls. I know I hate when people ask me to predict the future. So I'm going to ask you, but I'll leave it kind of open-ended so you can, you know, make the point you want to make. What are your thoughts on and feelings about where we are in this journey, where we're going, the impact of bad actors on our efforts to be an inclusive, you know, an ecosystem that welcomes people in, and yet we feel like, oh, come on, join the crypto ecosystem, but you got to watch out for all of this stuff. Like, you know, it's like when a tourist is visiting a city and you have to spend 20 minutes warning them about, you know, scams in the city and how they have to protect themselves. Like, it doesn't feel very welcoming. So where are we in this journey? Where are we going? And hopefully some optimism would be nice. You want to start, Ranwei?
Sure. I can start. With it. So I would say definitely we're still at a very early stage in this industry. Most of this newly built technology, there are many exciting ones, including zero knowledge proof, including formal verification, right? Including this kind of like right now, there are more and more on-chain monitoring data platforms and let's say instant response that Solana is building at this moment, the tools like TRM is building like after compromise, right? Kind of what it can do and so on. So I would say many more. So previously, people just try to build in this industry to enable that application and so on. Now we're trying to reveal that how to build it correctly. How to build it in a more legitimate way, such that we can have it can be adopted in a broader sense. And I would say happy to see the approval of Bitcoin ETF, and also happy to see this, as Ari said, as although in US, right, people are still arguing who gonna regulate this space, but in many other places, and governments are already trying to. See how to regulate it in the right way. And Solana's working with, let's say, Hong Kong governments, Singapore governments, Japan governments, and we try to provide our help, like help drafting these policies, right? Try to tell them, well, there are more risks and so on. And we hope that after, let's say, these infrastructures will be built and this space can be more ready to the wide adoption for average people. We hope that will come soon.
That's an awesome answer, and agree with all those points. David, you'll find that like I'm always very optimistic, particularly about this space where people are building so much cool stuff. I think what people forget is 2023 essentially began with FTX, right? Like FTX happened at the very, very end of 2022. And over the course of 1 year, we basically, I think, put behind us a really sort of, you know, dark chapter in the history of this space, you know, to include a criminal conviction, which that never happens in a year. I mean, like, particularly a complex case like that. And what we really saw over the course of 2023 is like, hey, we moved from this really problem with all this FUD in our space to a world where we were seeing more and more clarity and more consistency amongst global regulators about how to think about this space, how to think about stablecoins, how to think about centralized exchanges, even some thinking around DeFi. I'm the vice chair of the Technology Advisory Committee for the CFTC, and we put out a report a couple of weeks ago on decentralized finance, where we really tried to lay out not just the risks, right, but what are the opportunities? What is the technology? How does it function? So I'm hoping that 2024 is like the year of nuance, where we dive into a lot of these conversations. It's not just like, hey, this is how crypto is used for Terra financing, but it's how do we mitigate that risk, and really how bad is it? And it's not that bad today, right? So I think that I really hope that we have more sort of nuanced conversations. But I'm pretty excited about where the space is right now and how it's growing.
Well, you guys heard it here first. The theme for 2024 is nuance. Big thank you to my guests, Rongwei and Ari, for joining me today. It's a pleasure hosting you on Ripple's podcast, Blockstars.
Hey, David, thank you so much. This was awesome.
Yeah, thank you, David.
If you guys want to promote any social media handles or anything like that, now's your chance.
Yeah, my Twitter account handle is Ronghuigu. That's just Ronghuigu, my name, my first and last name.
Yeah, follow me on LinkedIn if you want a lot of more optimism.
I definitely need more optimism. Sometimes I feel like that is the thing I most need. Especially, you know what goes on in this space sometimes. It is a little depressing, so it's nice to have a balance of optimism.
Love it.
And awesome. Of course, a huge thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me on Twitter at Joel Katz, JoelKatz. And remember to follow Ripple XDev on Twitter. Keep up with the latest X, to keep up with the latest industry news, technical updates, and cool new developer projects in the community. See you around the blockchain.